The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com. And
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h. Org.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word,
word
of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Dr. Brené Brown's 2010 TED Talk, The Power of Vulnerability, struck a nerve. It quickly went viral and now has nearly 21 million views. Her follow-up talk has almost 6 million. The University of Houston-based research professor is now author of two best-selling books based on years of data. Her message, authentic human interactions, innovation, professional satisfaction, and meaningful relationships are only possible when we dare to expose our vulnerabilities and confront our shame. The message has been adapted by corporate leadership teams and Green Berets, along with therapists and yoga teachers. Ultimately, boldly doing battle with the self means sometimes landing flat on your face. And her new book, Rising Strong, is about how to get up, dust yourself off, and be willing to do it all over again. Brené Brown, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be with you.
Well, you write in the new book about the physics of vulnerability. Now, what does that mean?
You know, it was just the simplest way I could think of capturing this idea that if we're brave enough, often enough, we're going to fall down. We're going to experience heartbreak, disappointment, failure, screw-ups. It's just that simple. And I think people want to believe, well, if I try to be brave, I might risk getting hurt. But what I have found in my work is that if you are brave enough, you're not going to risk getting hurt. You're going to probably get hurt. Hmm. And that's especially true, I think, in this world of kind of hypercritical, unforgiving scrutiny.
So we will fall. And you've done a lot of research on how people get back up, which is a process you lay out in the book as the reckoning, the rumble, the revolution. Can you walk us through that briefly?
Yeah, I'd love to. It was interesting to me because the big research question I asked was, what do men and women who fall, who really struggle and get back up and are more courageous after having struggled and rising, what do they have in common? And there was a very clear process that they all really engaged in that almost became a practice in their lives. The first piece is the reckoning, where these men and women recognized that they were emotionally hooked by something, that their emotions were at play as a result of struggle, and they were willing to get curious about what is the emotion that I'm feeling, what has me so hooked, and what's really going on for me around this fall. And the second piece was, I call it the rumble. I was going to call it the dance, but then the more I got into the data, I'm like, no, it's not that balletic. It's like, it's a rumble. And this was the really big piece for me, the aha for me, is that what these men and women kept saying to me over and over was that they immediately reality checked the first story they told themselves about what was happening. And I would ask, like, what do you mean? They're like, well, you know, right when something hard happens, I think I have it all figured out. But if I'm willing to step back and really feel my way through it and dig into the episode even deeper, I figure out new things. And so the rumble is really about being very mindful of that first narrative we make up when something hard happens. Because when, let me tell you something, when something hard happens, we're neurobiologically wired to give emotion the first crack at understanding what it is. We need a story. Our brain scrambles and makes up a story very quickly to tell us what's happening, why it's happening, who's dangerous, who's safe. And so these men and women rumbled with that story and really dug into it, poked around, and reality checked it. And then the last thing was this process of recognizing that they're emotionally hooked, getting curious, and then digging into a story and rumbling with it wasn't just a process that they used once or twice. It became a practice in their lives. They were always kind of checking out the reliability of that inner narrator.
I want to go back to that idea of the narrative, the story, because all of the things that you just mentioned involve the kind of stories that we establish for ourselves. And you write a lot about the power of story on this biological and emotional level. Tell us more about what you found from researchers, your own and others, about how the brain kind of rewards our old stories.
You know, it was so fascinating to me because when something difficult happens, our brain is wired for one thing above all else, and that's survival. And so when there's a perceived threat, and a perceived threat can be, you know, getting fired, or it can be a strange look from our boss walking out of a meeting, we can feel, well, something's going on. And so our brain immediately goes into figure this out, get safe mode. And so our brain rewards us for patterns that help ensure our safety. And the brain recognizes that kind of narrative structure of beginning, middle, and end. And so when we make up a story, so let's say you and I walk out of a meeting and you give me a funny look, and I immediately, I'm like, oh my gosh, I knew Virginia didn't like me. I knew she didn't think I was smart. I knew she didn't think my ideas were very good. My brain immediately makes up a story. The dangerous thing is that we're rewarded chemically for that story.
Because it's like a well-trod path. I mean, we know what it looks like.
Right. And we're rewarded whether it's accurate or not.
Mm-hmm. You also write about the brain changing when getting curious, something else you mentioned in this reckoning process. Now, what do you mean by getting curious?
You know, it's one of my favorite things about this new research is that I really had to dig into the research on curiosity. And what we know from that existing research is that we need to have a small bit of knowledge and understanding about something to have curiosity about it. You know, we think we get curious about things we don't know anything about. But if you think about it, does it make sense? Because if we don't know anything about it, how do we want more knowledge? But the thing about the Rising Strong process is that we have to get curious about emotion. And that gets tricky when the majority of us were not raised asking a lot of questions or encouraged to ask a lot of questions about emotion and feeling. So in the Rising Strong process, what I found are the participants who can rise the strongest and the fastest have the deepest curiosity about emotion and their own emotional landscape. What am I feeling? What triggered it? Why?
We're talking to Dr. Brené Brown. Maybe you've heard of her. Her videos on vulnerability have been seen by tens of millions of people. Well, now she's found that if you're going to be vulnerable, you're going to fall. So how do you get back up? Her new book is all about that. It's called Rising Strong. Another thing in the book about the way that we process emotion is that there's this habit, I guess, of offloading emotions. Now, what does that mean?
Well, I think what's true for all of us in general is that we're better at inflicting pain on people than we are at feeling our own pain, or better at lashing out and hurting others rather than feeling our own hurt. So over time, we develop ways rather than to feel pain and feel our emotion and get curious about it, we have ways to offload it. Maybe we rage. Maybe we push things. I call it chandeliering. We push things down so far thinking that we can stay stoic and we can, you know, the stiff upper lip. And then one seemingly innocuous comment or something happens at work, and then all of a sudden we jump through our skin and we rage and we let loose. I think most of us have worked for someone like that. The other thing that we do is we numb. We use, you know, alcohol, television, sex, the internet, a myriad of things. We numb emotion rather than feeling it. Sometimes we use anger and blame. When something goes wrong, rather than feeling disappointed, we try to figure out whose fault it is, and we go into blaming. And so there's a lot of different ways, rather than feeling emotion, we push it off. And I think the hard thing is that emotion really dictates a lot of our behavior and thinking. So if we don't have some control and understanding of our emotion, we don't have a lot of control over our thinking, our behavior.
So if these are responses that we've been doing for years and stories, you know, get rewarded mm-hmm. that we've been making up for years, how do we recognize them? How do we discern the stories and the bad behavior from the truth?
That was a huge research question for me, is that, okay, I understand that these people engage in this process, but how does it work? And I have to say, close to 70% of the participants really documented those really kind of first stories. I call them SFDs, kind of stormy first drafts, the ones where we really are making up something to help us understand it. And by writing it down, and you know, there's a lot of research on the power of writing things down. And I don't mean a dissertation. I mean like on a post-it note or text it to yourself, jot it in a journal. I'm thinking about James Pennebaker's work from UT, University of Texas, Austin, that writing allows us to see, okay, here is what I've got in front of me. Here's what I'm making up about what's happening. What do I know to be true? It was so fascinating for me because when you look in the research, you find that a story that has limited actual data points where we go behind and fill in with our ideals and values, that's basically the definition of a conspiracy. And so one of the things that these men and women do who have the capacity to rise strong is they really check, reality check that conspiracy. Is it true that that look meant this? Am I assigning all this to something or is it true? And I think what we find is the more courageous way to live, if we walk out of a meeting and you look funny, you know, you give me a throw a funny look my way, is for me to walk up and say, hey, Virginia, we were walking out of that meeting this morning and I thought you kind of looked at me in a funny way and I made up that you have a concern with something I shared in there or that you're concerned about my idea. I just want to check in with you and see what's going on. Which gives you the opportunity to say, no, I just, I was late for another meeting and my tennis elbow is acting up. And then all of a sudden, this huge conflict and this swirling narrative that, you know, but we don't do that normally. We don't check things out. What we do is now I'm angry and now you ask me to do a favor for you. And I said, no, I'm not going to do it. And now you're thinking, what's going on with Brené? And it's just a very simple question to ask people, you know, as people are listening today, like how many of you have ever gotten in a conflict with someone and that person walked out of your office or out of the living room and you have an entire narrative made up about what's happening?
I've never done anything like that, Brené.
Me neither. I'm just saying, theoretically.
but you know, what you're talking about is more vulnerability and exposure. I mean, there's the risk that that person might say to you, oh, you know what, Brené, you really did disappoint me in that meeting. I mean, you're making me think of this expression, I don't know if you've heard it, that you can't save your rear end and your face at the same time.
Oh, yeah, no, you can't.
But so more vulnerability, really? Is that the answer?
Yes.
We have to just expose ourselves more? But
yes,
what's the danger?
I know it's the danger. Okay, so the danger is that I circle back with you and say, hey, we walked out of the meeting. You looked at me funny. Were you upset about something that happened? And you said, you know what? As a matter of fact, I really did not appreciate the way that you kind of threw that story on the table when, you know, we're still working on it. And I've asked everyone not to share it until we have it complete. But that's better. It's uncomfortable. But let me tell you, the number of uncomfortable moments in our lives is directly correlated to the level of bravery and courage we have with our lives. Because then at least that way I have the ability to say, oh my God, I'm sorry. I apologize. You're right. I got really excited about it and I didn't think about it. Or I have the ability to say, you know what, Virginia, I wasn't in that meeting last week and I didn't realize it. I apologize. Let me help you clean it up and let's move forward. But either way, we're better off for it.
Well, you're talking about digging into some of the things that plague us, you know, that we rumbling with these things that we've been dealing with for a long time, which is a very different way to engage than just think positive or act as if you don't have any of these problems, which is advice people have been given to get over destructive or hurtful parts of our stories for years.
I'm not a fan.
Of the just think positive?
No, I really am not. I don't know what that means. I don't see that. It's not even in my fandom is irrelevant, really. I don't see that in the data at all. I see people doing really hard things that are very uncomfortable in order to build meaningful, purposeful relationships. And so I've come to the point in my work based on the data where I believe that we are called to choose courage over comfort sometimes 20 times a day. And I think that's what matters. I think that's what works. And I think pretending, pleasing, perfecting, proving, the whole litany of P words, apparently, I don't think that gets us where we need to be.
Well, you have advised us how to own ourselves, to dig in deep, be willing to fall, now how to get up. So where to next?
You know, I don't know. I really don't know. And for someone who writes about vulnerability and uncertainty, you'd think I'd be comfortable not knowing, but I'm not comfortable. But I actually don't know. And I think I'm just going to let it emerge.
Well, what a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Virginia. I appreciate it.
Dr. Brené Brown, she's a research professor at the University of Houston, and her TED Talks have been seen almost 27 million times. She has 2 New York Times bestsellers to her credit, and her new book is called Rising Strong. There's more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There are actuarial tables and plenty of lists to help you figure out whether you've hit middle age. There's the gray hair, inability to read your phone, and failure to recognize songs on the radio. But as NHPR Sean Hurley reflects from his home in the White Mountains, middle age may be simply noticing a shift in perspective.
I wake early from the crows screeching through the different open windows of our house. Chalkboard screams demanding rebates, wanting to talk to the mayor. It's not even 6, and I'm like a human anchor, heavy and down below the blanket still. But my wife and son sleep on, despite the racket, and I go outside and sit in a wet chair and drink coffee on the porch. If I can't sleep, at least I can find out what's going on. The sky is hard and cloudless and cloud-colored, still showing stars you don't have to notice if you don't want. The crows go shipping tree to tree, battling left and right and back, a little less than shadows, even when I see them clearly. Suddenly, 3 crows flap together in a mid-air pile, like something that can't turn into a jacket. But the dispute is all crow and beyond the power of an anchor and a wet chair to discern. The fight ends, and the quiet crows separate as the paper sky turns blue, with clouds coming in, like empty thought bubbles. Another murder mystery unsolved. Crow upon cloud, upon sky, upon stars, over anchor. Late afternoon in a pouring rain, the crows forgotten. I drive to the Smarts Brook trailhead and park. There's only one other car in the lot, and except for that someone, I'll have the whole woods to myself. Whatever little speed that marks the difference between walking and running is the speed I jog. I used to be fast, and now I'm slow. I'm 48, and that's how many minutes it'll take me to run the 3-mile loop around the river. I seem to lose a minute every year. Out of the car, into the rain, I jump into the first water I see to get my shoes wet. The trail is one long puddle, as nearly flowing as the brook it follows. 2 miles in, across the bridge, wet as a swimmer, and descend the log road, and suddenly, a red dog is beside me. Something ahead has his attention, and he hardly sees me as he shoots off, feet skipping like stones on the rivery path. I turn and look behind as a fast figure races along, and like his dog, hardly sees me as he passes. But I recognize him and call out through the rain to the Olympic skier, Chris Freeman. He's just run up and down Sandwich Mountain, he says, 6 miles each way. The volume is up, but I'm always tired, he says. My volume is down, and I am too, I joke. As he has been for years, Freeman says he's training for the next Olympics. Me too, I say. An expert, not the kind of dry as a bone, laid down and died joke that used to make me blush when my father told them. But Freeman nods as though this is somehow possible. And, for a moment, 2 Olympians splash together side by side until the red dog again speeds away and Freeman follows. I try to keep up, but they're both so fast that I stop cold. My shoes fill with water as I watch them go, heading off even now for the Olympics. In the morning, in a wet chair with an unsolved mystery of crows overhead. In the afternoon, in a puddle, watching a dreamer chase his dog and his dream. It's a good enough metaphor for the middle age I've struck upon. Investigator of unsolvable bird mysteries. Checker of dreams in the watery woods. Crow upon cloud, upon sky, upon stars. Over anchor. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. With the trans celebrities Caitlyn Jenner and Laverne Cox in the spotlight, more and more individuals are coming forward with their own stories about gender ambiguity, which from a biological perspective is a lot more common than most people think. Studies at Brown University found that one out of every 2,000 people is born with ambiguous genitalia or other traits that fall somewhere on the male-female spectrum, but many of them grow up without knowing it. Doctors regularly perform surgeries on infants that will determine which gender that child will identify with for life. An increasing number of parents, legal experts, and bioethicists are questioning whether intersex babies should be operated on. The first public lawsuit on that question is scheduled for November. Azeen Ghorashi, a science reporter for BuzzFeed News and author of the article Born in Between, Should Doctors Operate on Intersex Babies? And Azeen, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, you focus on a lawsuit over a child called MC in the article, stemming from the circumstances of the child's birth. Now, what was the condition?
So MC was born with ovotesticular disorder of sexual development. It's an incredibly rare form of intersex. It's about one in every 20,000 babies are born with this particular condition. So it's basically that he has both ovarian and testicular tissue. He's pretty much split down the middle in terms of which biological traits are female and which biological traits are male. So it presents a little bit more difficult of a quandary for doctors at birth about what to do and sort of, you know, guessing what gender he's going to grow up to identify with.
And you call him he. What did they do for MC?
So MC was actually a ward of the state by the time doctors were trying to determine whether to operate on him. So the state was really making the decisions about his care, which is part of the lawsuit, actually. The doctors looked at all of his genetic information, looked at his anatomy, which included a penis and a vagina. It included one testicle and, like I said, both ovarian and testicular tissue. And they basically determined that he could have gone either way. If you look at the doctor's notes, when MC was 60 months old, they basically said that it was very, very hard to determine sort of which way he was going to swing, and they could swing it kind of in either direction based on how they decided to operate is sort of the language that they were using. One key thing was that he did have fairly high levels of testosterone at birth that are usually normal for males of his same age. But ultimately, they decided to go with a female gender assignment. So they removed all of his male anatomy and assigned him as a female. Of course, now I'm using the male gender pronoun. He is now 10 years old and identifies as a boy.
Well, Azeen, data from Brown University estimates one in every 2,000 babies born in the U.S. have a range of traits, you know, falling somewhere on this spectrum of male and female. But you found some doctors argue that it could be even higher.
Right. So it sort of depends on where you decide to draw the line on what is intersex and what isn't. Doctors and scientists are basically finding out that there are more and more and more ways that there isn't this perfect binary of sex of male and female. But some doctors do say that it could be as many as 1 in 100 babies that are born with intersex conditions.
Well, tell us about this lawsuit. This is Pam and Mark Crawford, who adopted MC, or are they foster parents?
They adopted him, yeah.
And the state of South Carolina. So what is the argument the Crawfords are making?
So they adopted MC. I think they brought him home at the age of 20 months. And he was at that point, they had brought home a baby girl. They knew about his condition, and they actually, Pam had grown up, and one of her friends had actually had an intersex condition. And so she was a little bit more aware of sort of the issues around it. First thing she said when she found out about MC's condition was, have they done surgery? And they said yes, and she was pretty disappointed about that. Mm-hmm. But anyways, they brought home this baby girl. They raised her as a baby girl until about the age of 4 or so, I think. MC started sort of asserting a little bit more boyish behaviors, you know, playing with trucks and wanting to be on the boys' team and all these things that they didn't make too much of, just because Pam and Mark are both, I'd say, a little bit on the hippie side. They're like, you know, not one to dress her up in a pink dress or anything like that. They were definitely, they'd raised a tomboy before and weren't going to read too much into anything like that. But as he got older, he sort of started making these stronger and stronger assertions. He asked to have his hair cut like Dad's, which, you know, they explained that he might be mixed up with a boy, and MC said that he didn't mind. They went on a family trip to a water park, and MC begged his mom to please be allowed to exist there as a boy. At this point, I think the parents started to see that maybe there was something going on. And I think at the age of 7, he decided that he wanted to, that he was a boy. And that's really just what he was. So he went in front of his class and he told them. And it was his words, actually, the born in between that we used in our headline was actually straight out of the mouth of a 7-year-old, which is about the simplest way to put it.
So what's the nature of the suit, and why isn't it against the doctor who made the decision?
So they are not suing over the fact that they got his gender wrong, right? That MC was surgically altered to be a girl and that he is now grown into being a boy. They are suing over the issue of informed consent. They are alleging that the doctors did not do enough to inform his caregivers at the time, which were social workers for the state of South Carolina and foster parents. They're alleging that they did not pose enough of an option of not doing the surgery and did not make clear enough the sort of potential negative consequences of doing the surgery itself.
In their mind, what would those negative consequences be?
Well, MC, for example, now cannot procreate as a male. Obviously, that's a big one. There's psychological impacts of the surgery happening, the possibility that he was going to grow into being a boy, and the sort of gender dysmorphia that comes with that is something he's going to have to deal with for the rest of his life. He's going to have to go on to hormone therapy at this point once he hits puberty to continue to live as a boy. These are all risks that the Crawfords are alleging the doctors should have informed his caregivers of.
We're speaking with Azine Gureishi. She's science reporter for BuzzFeed News. And she wrote about a lawsuit involving a commonly performed surgical procedure on babies who are born intersex or with ambiguous genitalia. So the doctors make decisions pretty much on the spot. Are there any qualms within the field of medicine about this informed consent, you know, picking one gender over the other?
Actually, I mean, the standard of care has changed a lot since this practice pretty much started in the mid-50s. You know, the kids that were originally operated on when this sort of rolled out in American medicine, their parents kept it secret from them. The doctors told the parents to do was to never let them know that these surgeries had happened. You know, there weren't counseling services. There weren't all these things that now doctors will point out have really changed in terms of how we deal with intersex babies. Parents are now, at least at the good hospitals in the U.S. that are a little bit more forward-thinking about this stuff, they're given a lot more resources in terms of how to deal with their kid's condition and how to support them. And the parents themselves are supported. And some more progressive doctors, I talked to one guy out of UCSF and in San Francisco, and he's sort of this new school that says that, you know, we need to only do sort of minimally invasive surgeries. They used to, if a girl was born with an extra large clitoris, for example, they would cut that down to make her look more acceptably like a girl. Now, Dr. Sandro in San Francisco, for example, he won't do that. He'll leave it alone. He says that doesn't meet the bar for what we should operate on. But he does do these sort of minimally invasive reversible surgery so that there is room left over for a kid to make a choice later on in life.
Is that the alternative, to do a minimally invasive surgery that can be reversed rather than just letting them go and be gender ambiguous until they can make a decision with their parents, presumably later?
I mean, if you talk to the intersex activists, they don't even agree with what Dr. DeSandro is proposing. I mean, a minimally invasive surgery is still a surgery. Why are we operating at all? The issue of informed consent, if you take it even further, I mean, this is an infant that has no agency in terms of making decisions about their own body, right? They're 16 months old.
Mm-hmm.
So the activists really do push that further to exactly what you just said, to let the kid have the choice and make the decision with their parents and their doctors once they are a fully formed human being, once their form of gender identity is more solidified.
Of course, this is, you said, been done since the 1950s. Is there any data at all on outcomes for people who did not have the surgery as a child versus people who had the surgeries?
This is also part of the problem, is that there's so little scientific backing for sort of whether this is a good idea or a bad idea. There have been a couple of studies. They tend to contradict each other because it's a really small sample size. It's both a rare condition and there hasn't been that much research into it. So doctors are really, as of 2011, are starting to sort of team up with researchers to determine sort of those long-term outcomes and see sort of what works best. A lot of what we do have is personal testimonies, and those are a little bit harder to make sense of, obviously, because people will peg them as the good eggs or the bad eggs. But, you know, there are some individuals that grew up without any surgical alteration, and I spoke to one of them for my story, and she claimed she lived a totally normal life. She said that as far as the differences she did have to deal with, you know, going through high school, a lot of the claims made are about that these kids might be bullied for being different. She said that, you know, the most different thing that was perceived about her was the fact that her parents were immigrants, and that was a much harder thing to sort of struggle with in high school.
It's a very big case, and I'm wondering what might happen if the Crawfords do win the case. Will it be so decisive that medical professionals will be forbidden from these surgeries or think twice about it, or there will be some medical ethical review board for making these decisions?
Right. I mean, no one really knows what will happen if they win, but they certainly won't be restricted by the law, in the sense that it won't be illegal for these surgeons to continue to operate. What will likely happen is that doctors will stop sort of operating out of fear of similar malpractice suits being brought against them. You know, if this is successful, it sets a precedent for more successful lawsuits, essentially.
Well, Azine, thank you so much. We'd love to check in with you after the case goes to trial.
Yeah, of course.
Azine Gureshi, she's science reporter for BuzzFeed News, and she recently wrote the article called Born in Between, Should Doctors Operate on Intersex Babies? There's a link to read her article along with some really interesting photographs at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It began, as many things do today, online. First, a screenshot of Korean-American actress Samantha Futterman from a short film posted on YouTube.
Holy shit, is that a mullet? You look like Billy Ray Cyrus, but Asian, okay? So please just leave.
I'm gonna leave now.
You should
go. You're a terrible
Bye.
Person.
Bye.
A design student in London noticed that the actress in the video looked just like his friend, Anaïs Bourdier, a young French woman who'd been adopted from South Korea. Anaïs dug around and found videos and pictures online of this young woman who looked just like her and discovered that they shared the same birthday and were both adopted from the same town. Was it possible they could be twins? Well, it's an amazing story, but the two girls, adopted and raised on two continents, found each other on social media 25 years later. Anaïs Bourdier and Samantha Futterman are authors of the book Separated at Birth. A new documentary about their experience called Twinsters is currently showing in select theaters. We spoke to the sisters when the film was in production, and I asked Anaïs what her first thoughts were when her friend Kelsang sent her the screenshot of the woman who looked just like her.
First, I was really angry because I thought somebody had just posted a video of myself on YouTube without asking permission for it. And then, after 5 seconds, clicking on the link, I discovered it was a video of a girl who looked exactly like me.
Mm-hmm. She was not credited in that little short film. You, however, raised in Paris and Brussels. Now, what did you know about the circumstances of your birth and your adoption from South Korea at that time?
So what I knew was that I was a single child and then that my birth mother couldn't keep me. Mm-hmm. I didn't know anything about my birth father. You know, we didn't have much more information except she was young, probably.
Mm-hmm. Even your adoptive mother didn't think it could have been possible that you had a twin because she said to the adoption agency she would take twins if they had them, right?
Yes, indeed. They would have been happy to adopt siblings, you know, but they were not presented the opportunity, actually, on the paper.
So, Sam, you got a Facebook message from Anaïs in February of 2013. You were a little doubtful. Why?
Well, I guess when you get a friend request from yourself on Facebook is a bit jarring experience. And I thought she was my friend Kev Jumba is a popular YouTuber. I thought she was just a fan, like a crazy fangirl of his.
Mm-hmm.
But then after, again, like my sister was saying, clicking into the pictures, I realized she was a actual person. And then after reading the message and finding out that we were born in the same day in the same place, I began to realize that it could be true.
Now, what convinced you then to have that first conversation on Skype? How did you feel leading into that?
Leading into the Skype, it's mm-hmm. nerve-wracking. I mean, mm-hmm. you don't know what's going to pop up on the other side of the screen, you know? It could be some crazy person across the world. But, I mean, it's just the next logical step after meeting each other through message. The next step is Skype, right? And then to go on to meet in person.
What were you looking for? I mean, I'm sure the physical, you write about, you know, sort of like she had the same freckles, you know, the same expressions. But were you kind of testing each other to figure out how you were similar in the world?
Yes, we have the same same size, the same, I guess, voice intonation, but very different accents. We have the same, some similar habits. We had the same haircuts when we were children, which is really strange because we were not anywhere close in the world and our parents were still choosing our haircuts. Yes, we discovered so many similarities. We did some cognitive test with Dr. Nancy Siegel, and except for, how do you call it?
Like emotional testing.
Yeah, emotional testing. The other tests look so similar. The results are so close. You know, it feels nature is so strong as well.
Yeah, this is Dr. Siegel. She's been a researcher, a lead researcher on a study that's gone on for 20 years from University of Minnesota, study of twins reared apart. Well, what did this reveal to either of you about your thinking on nature versus nurture?
It definitely changed my perspective. I thought mostly everything was nurture, but finding out that DNA definitely plays a big role in our genetic and social makeup.
Mm-hmm. What do you remember, Sam, as being some of the similarities between the two of you?
Our math scores were surprisingly low for us two Asian girls. But we're very visual people, so we could recognize patterns quite quickly. But then the differences, too, were really interesting with the nurture. It's just, I think, growing up with brothers and growing up as an only child and just in the vast different environments, you know, and how we were treated as adoptees growing up.
I'm also reading here in the book, you both hated cook vegetables, brush your teeth many, many times a day. Both require 10 hours of sleep a night plus daily naps.
Yeah, we don't get the sleep much anymore. So not, many, many little naps in.
Not on a book tour, certainly. I mean, you also had kind of different emotional responses to your circumstances of birth. I mean, a lot gets revealed in this book about how the Korean agency, that Korean agency in particular, was run. And since you've discovered that there are several other twins and sets of triplets that have been separated, now, do you know why they were separated?
I think a lot had to do with the economical situation in Korea at the time and that many families couldn't afford to take care of two young children, especially after having multiple children already.
So I feel that was mostly the case, and one child was kept with the birth family. But for us, it was kind of a very, very unique circumstance.
Mm-hmm. Both of you, as similar as you are, both of you had kind of different responses to the response from your birth mother. Now that you go to the agency in South Korea, trying to find your mother, you do find a foster mother, but the woman who was ID'd as your mother denied giving birth to you two. You both seem to have different feelings about that. Can you articulate those for us?
Yes. I mean, I understand her choice of not responding now. Maybe it's not her, but it probably is. I'm very respectful towards her choice. I hope that someday she will want to talk to us, but we don't know the circumstances. So sometimes you don't want to. I mean, we're so happy already that we found each other, and I'm feeling that I don't want to know more because it sounds like she had probably a difficult time or she was in a difficult situation. So I don't want to go too far in the research if she's not ready for it yet.
Sam, how about you? You're a little more eager in your pursuit?
I was in the, like, you know, before the situation when I was going back to Korea for the first time, I put out a call to try to find her. It was something that the opportunity again presented itself. So I thought, why not do it now? But now that she's denied it, you understand that, you know, it's her life, too. It's not just us. It's not just about us. It's about the entire family, and every person has a side of the story. So hopefully one day we'll find her, but again, we don't want to press her because she has feelings, too. It's not just us. So one day, if we have the chance, that would be amazing. And if it never happens, then we have each other.
Well, there'll be a whole other story in another book, I can imagine. Well, you've been on this world now for 18 months, working on a documentary film, you know, written this book, you know, you're doing press right now. So where do you go from there? I mean, there's this initial excitement. Is there a wish to kind of reconstruct your lives together? How do you carry on with a twin sister you never had?
Well, our bond is too strong. I don't think we can spend too much time apart. So there's no fear of losing each other now, that's for sure.
Yeah, I feel exactly the same. Like, we have social medias. We can WhatsApp every day. We can Skype whenever we want. I can wake up my sister if I want in the middle of her night on the West Coast. And, yeah, I mean, we've been traveling a lot. We speak the same language, which is amazing. So we can communicate. And I guess we're not scared to just travel above ocean.
Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us. I appreciate it. Merci bien, Anaïs.
Merci beaucoup.
And Samantha Futterman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was our previous conversation with the twins Anaïs Bordier and Samantha Futterman, authors of Separated at Birth and creators of the documentary Twinsters, which is currently showing in select theaters. You can watch a trailer for the film and find out where it's playing at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today as we explored some reunions, whether between long-lost twins or the old familiar self with the unfamiliar self. There is much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. That's where you'll find your subscription to the Word of Mouth podcast. You can also sign up for it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, write a review or pass it along. Tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney. The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.